The first property I bought at auction, lunch went on and on, and I think a little bit too much of the old vino was consumed. And we thought we'd go into the auction, see how it was going. I opened the catalogue, and there was this property in Blackburn. And I said to Rob, if we buy 10 of these, we'll be rich and have a property portfolio. So I duly put my hand up, well, I think the bottle of wine put my hand up, bought the property, foundation of a massive empire. Pulled up outside the property, there was no front door. So I said to him, what's going on? He said, oh, the guy vacated yesterday and took the front door because he put a new one on and felt it was his.
You're listening to Expat Property Story, a podcast in which I share my story to smooth the way for you to have your own. Expat Property
Story. Hello there. That was the voice of David Sandyman, founder of the Essential Information Group, introducing episode 53, which is a compilation of auction tales of the unexpected, which I've collected from some of my guests from season 2, which culminated in a successful conclusion to my four-month challenge to purchase a UK property at auction from my home here in Hong Kong without setting foot in the UK.
Previously on Expat Auction Story.
What a ride it's been. It seems like a decade ago that I first looked into the idea of buying a property at auction, prompted by my guest from back in episode 19, John Howard, who told me that if you can't find a deal out of the 2,500 plus properties put up for auction each month, then you must be a sandwich short of a picnic. He made it sound so easy, and to be fair, it's definitely a whole load easier now than it was when my challenge began, partly because the market has definitely shifted from one that favoured sellers to one that now favours buyers. The catalogues are bigger than ever, and more people are sitting it out waiting to see what happens, presenting opportunities to those brave enough to take advantage of the bargains on offer. Another reason it's become easier is that I now know how to analyse a deal. The more deals you analyse, the quicker it becomes. And this is vital for when an opportunity crops up, because it's the speed with which you're able to take action and perform that will mean you winning the property over those that drag their feet. And by the way, if you'd like a copy of my 23-step guide to analysing a deal, all you need to do is to sign up to the email subscription service via the podcast website at www.expatpropertystory.com, and we'll forward you a copy. Now, as anyone who has published a podcast will tell you, it's a lot more work than you'd think. So it's always nice when someone takes the time to acknowledge the hard work that goes into creating free content for others. And it's been a while since I've received a 5-star review, so I thought I'd read it out here. Great content with great personality. With so many property podcasts around these days, it's great to find a nice, down-to-earth, informative podcast that really does follow real-life situations, rather than regurgitating media content without putting it into potential situations. Being an expat as well, currently Hong Kong, it's also nice to have content that covers the many pains and gripes that we have to go through, including viewing, buying, refurbishing, and managing properties remotely. Keep up the good work. This kind person didn't leave their name, and my wife convincingly assured me that it's definitely not her. So, whoever you are, thank you very much. Now, before we dive into some auction tales of the unexpected, I would just like to tell you about my plans for the podcast over the next month or so. Regulars will know that around about June, we went daily for a mini-season of tax-related bite-sized episodes presented by friend of the pod, Sean, the property tax accountant. And one of those is in the top three for most downloaded episodes. They're all worth checking out, however, so if you haven't already done so, go back to episodes 23 to 29, and if you have already done so, they're all probably worth listening to again. Well, anyway, we're going daily again, this time for the 12 days of Christmas, as I run through my top 10 books for expat property investors by presenting one book a day, starting on Boxing Day, counting down from 10 to 1. But the day before that, on Christmas Day, I have some gifts lined up for you, as I'll be joined by some of my amazing guests as they name their favourite resources. And as if that's not enough already, we're running a competition with a fantastic prize generously offered by the aforementioned John Howard, who was the one who turned me on to auctions in the first place. John is offering a free place on his next auction seminar for the lucky listener who manages to guess what his favourite resource for property investors is. The prize will go to whoever guesses it first, and if no one gets it right away, we'll have a lucky draw for all those who enter the competition to decide who gets this fabulous prize. John Howard's seminars cost upwards of £500. And because he has bought and sold many thousands of properties in his 40 plus years of investing, this really is a competition worth entering. So next week, I'll provide more details of how to enter. So tap follow on Spotify or the little plus icon if you listen on Apple Podcasts to make sure you don't miss out on this amazing opportunity. Now, as promised, here are some auction tales of the unexpected, starting with Jay Howard.
One I didn't witness myself. So one was kind of like a round a campfire with auctioneers and auction solicitors and auction finance people. We were telling our worst stories. So this one was from Scott Hendry from Together Money. He was at, I can't remember which auction it was, but I have the feeling it was one of the top three at the time. This was a number of years ago. So it must have been either Savills or Sops or Barnum Markets. Must have been one of those three. Lady obviously didn't read the auction catalogue properly. Bids, is fighting out, wins the property, then goes over to Scott, who has a stand at the auction and says, I bought this. Can you finance it for me? He goes, oh, how much you pay for it? Let's call it, I paid £174,000. The number is irrelevant for now. £174,000. And he's like, oh, so, you know, what income is coming in? Oh, she goes, it's this at the bottom. But, you know, it's the whole building. And he was like, yeah, it's the whole building. But all of the leases have been sold off.
All she had in fact bought was the freehold, without the individual leaseholds, meaning the only income she could expect was from the ground rent.
I paid £174,000 for a ground rent. So that one was crazy.
While some don't read the legal pack, others are determined to win, whatever the cost.
The one that really sticks with me the most for being completely absurd, absolutely absurd, we were selling a property in Fulham, Mercer Road or something like that. And basically, it was a mid-terrace Edwardian-style property. So lower ground, raised ground, first, second floor. It didn't have a roof. The roof was off. The thing had been vacant for 10 years. It was the ugliest property on the best-looking road. Auction written all over it. And I think we guided it at £500,000. And the potential for this building was to extend out the basement into the garden, do a loft extension, well, put a loft on it first, but then do the loft extension, just turn it into one of those big, beautiful Fulham-style, like, town terraced houses that you see. Had so much potential. We got a phone call from a lady who had a really thick American accent. Don't ask me from where, but definitely English lady, but with an American accent, which means she'd been there for a good 20, 30 years. She explained that she was getting a flight and she couldn't arrive the day earlier, but she was going to arrive at like 7 o'clock in the morning. She wants to go and view the asset. Can someone get her in? We just couldn't do it because it was auction morning. We're all in the auction trying to get everything prepared, so we just can't do it. So this woman turns up. She wasn't alone. She came to the auction. It was her, maybe a husband, whoever, don't want to assume too much. And she had a newspaper in her hand. So the bidding started on this property. This woman didn't break eye contact with the auctioneer, had her hand in the air, didn't flinch, didn't even think about flinching. Just the ballsiness of it. Like this, you have to understand, like, the level of insanity of, like, most people thinking, right, oh, so that person been, oh, no, it's my turn. Zero. F-U-C-K-S's were employed in this situation. Didn't flinch, had her hand in the air, in the middle of the room. Everybody could see her. She was playing no games, just sheer aggression. Like, she was doing the whole, come on, try me, fight me, I'm going to win, right? She won, of course she won. So from £500,000, it sold for, like, I want to say about 1.2 million-ish, right? If you did all the works on that property, maybe there was about £500,000 worth of extension works and refurb, because it hadn't had a roof on it for like 10 years. So, like, floorboards, everything would have to come out and start again almost, right? You're talking about £500,000 worth of kit. At the end of it, the property would be worth no more than 1.8 to 1.9. Maybe, you know, probably in today's market, quite a bit more, right? That was one of the craziest things I've seen, because nobody acts like that. No one goes into an auction room and does that. It's insanity on the face of it. They hadn't seen it. They hadn't read the legal pack. She came in like an absolute whirlwind and won it absolutely crazy.
And from the cocky to the, well, maybe I should let the next tale of the unexpected introduce itself.
Well, this is funny, I guess, but I've seen someone buy pretty much an adopted road up in Manchester, which was the shape of a dick, pretty much. So it was the shape of the penis.
Right.
And they ended up buying that just for the sake of buying it, just to say that this is what I own. So I'd say that was pretty funny, to be honest with you. But yeah, that probably.
And how much did that penis cost?
Top of my head, guide price was 10K. I think it ended up going for 20, 30K. But I'm sure someone's going to create some kind of digital.
Just because of its shape.
Yeah, exactly. And I think someone's going to create some kind of digital artwork out of it somewhere and send it as an NFT, whatever the hell that people are doing these days.
Wow. Okay. Yeah. Well, there you go. You have delivered on that question.
Yeah. Get someone to beat that one, eh?
Well, I'm not sure if we can beat that one, but we'll give it a go. David Sandyman, founder of the aptly named Essential Information Group, has a mantra that I've mentioned on here before, namely that the most important document in the legal pack is the one that isn't there. But David has another one up his sleeve from personal experience, and it is, don't go to an auction when you've had a drink.
I'll come into the confessional here. The first property I bought at auction, held in a new Connaught Rooms in London, Edward Evans, and I went out for lunch with my business partner, and lunch went on and on, and I think a little bit too much of the old vino was consumed. And we thought we'd go into the auction, see how it's going. Sat down, and I opened the catalogue, and there was this property in Blackburn up north, the other side of Manchester, coming up, guided at £10,000. And it had an income of, I think, 1,100 quid a year, let to a guy who repaired domestic machines. And I said to Rob, let's buy this. If we buy 10 of these, we'll be rich and wealthy and have a property portfolio. So I duly put my hand up, well, I think the bottle of wine put my hand up, got the lot for £10,000, went up, paid my deposit check. This is back in 83, I think this was, and bought the property, very excited. Hangover the next day, phoned my lawyer, said, I just bought a property. I'm getting the papers biked over to you. Mobile phones were just coming in then. I had one. I thought, well, I'll drive up and look at my new property, foundation of a massive empire. Pulled up outside the property. There was no tenant there and no front door. So I said to him, what's going on? He said, oh, the guy vacated yesterday and took the front door because he put a new one on and felt it was his. So whilst that was all going on, my lawyer phoned me. He said, Dave, he said, did you read the legal pack? I said, do me a favour, Andrew. I've just been out for lunch. I hadn't thought of buying this. He said, ah, so you're not aware that the tenant hasn't been paying the rent for the last 2 years and you owe the rent on top in the purchase price. So anyway, I had to then, and it's full of junk. So I then had to go and buy a door, chisels and a drill and hang it. And I don't like carpentry. Hang a door, fit a lock. And what are we going to do with it? So I thought, well, I'll put it with a local auctioneer. So I phoned up Longdon and Cook and said, could you sell this for us? And they said, yes. And actually, they got 12 and a half grand for it.
So you made a profit.
So we got out of it, but it could have ended in tears. I mean, I don't want to have been trying to manage it.
Yeah, and you don't want to be hanging doors on a hangover.
No, sharp chisels around. But yeah, that, I think, was interesting situation.
So if even the great David Sandyman has bought a property at auction without viewing it first, it's no surprise that others have made the same mistake. Here's Andrew Brown from Stretton's.
I do remember a story that was told to me by a selling client of mine. They had bought something in, it was a property somewhere in the Northwest, and they bought it without looking at it first to that auction. And they'd come across it on the morning of the auction and decided to go along and they'd bid. And of course, there was just a photograph of the front. It was a sort of a regular sort of terraced house. And what they hadn't realised was that when they went to visit it that afternoon, after they'd been successful in buying it, that there was no back wall, that it had been completely collapsed behind. So they learned a very valuable lesson there, that to make sure they read the details properly and to view the property. And there was another one as well that I remember hearing of, where someone had sold a house, there were no viewings. Again, it was in the Northwest, is obviously a bit of a theme here. There were no viewings on the property. And when the eventual buyer got in and discovered that there were, I think there was something like 3,000 used tyres.
Wow.
Backed up, stored in the property. And I think it was obviously because, you know, you've got to pay to dispose of tyres, and people were taking these tyres or having people pay them, take them away, and rather than disposing of them in an environmentally safe manner, they were just sticking them in this house. So, and someone bought that and hadn't realised. But as they touch wood, I've no sort of, you know, I've never heard any particular sort of, you know, horror stories of things that I've sold, fortunately. But again, it does illustrate the necessity for doing one's homework.
I can't imagine buying a property only to find it filled with thousands of used tyres. What a nightmare. Well, a similar thing happened to Jay Howard, but I'm sure he'll never tire of telling this story. See what I did there? We'll be back with the podcast in a second, but I just wanted to let you know that we help high net worth individuals who perhaps don't have the time, expertise, or contacts to find deals that stack right now. We can offer fixed rate returns of up to 12%. So instead of watching your savings get swallowed by inflation, why not schedule a free call via the link in the show notes to see how we might work together? Now, back to the pod.
property auction. It was probably one of the last semi-detached houses with a garage on that road. And I don't think anyone had really kind of appreciated it. It was in Hounslow, that Middlesex kind of West London way. But the house needed gutting, and I'm not a big fan of gutting. And I went to the property. You couldn't open the garage, so I didn't know what was in the garage. So I bought the property. The numbers elude me off the top of my head. But time came to actually complete. We completed. I went there and I got the bolt cutters and we opened up the garage, and there was just newspapers. Folded newspapers, like from front to back, you couldn't see anything else. So we started emptying out this garage, and all of it went to recycling before eco warriors come after me. All of those newspapers went to recycling. And then under all these newspapers was a big tarp. So I pulled the tarp off, and there was an E-Class Jag, like a 1967, 1969 E-Class Jag. I thought, wow, I've just got this car for free, right? You have to approach DVLA. Because I said, look, I bought this property and it was sold as seen, all contents. I had to clear out the house as well. Then I became the proud owner of this Jag.
Did you not have doubts that you actually owned the Jag?
No, no doubts at all. No. Essentially, the moment I completed on the transaction with the house, I owned everything in it.
And did you ever get to the bottom of why they'd left an E-type Jag in there? The person selling it didn't know it was there?
It was a probate sale. The probate had no idea the car was there. From my understanding, they didn't go in the garage. They did know it was filled with newspapers. The chap who passed away was a hoarder. I think I made more money selling the Jag than I did in flipping the house.
And how much did you make on the Jag?
I made over £100,000 on the Jag. I made a decent amount on the house, maybe £50,000 or £60,000 for a 3-month flip.
Wow. So £150,000, £160,000.
And the people who bought it from me, they subsequently knocked the garage down and got planning for a double story side extension. And then I think last time I looked, I think they've actually split it into two different houses now. So
I myself have just exchanged contracts on a 3-bed semi with a detached garage without having viewed the property prior to purchase, which is not as crazy as it sounds, trust me. And I'll be telling the full story in the new year. But I'm definitely now looking forward to getting into that garage to see if the previous owner was careless enough to leave a vintage car lying around. The teller of this next tale did view the property just before completion, and it's just as well he did. It's Jay's business partner, Piotr Ruzinek, and there was definitely no hidden treasure in this one.
It was actually my first auction property that we purchased, and it was a JV as well. We bought this 2-bedroom flat in Camberwell in 2015. Actually, it was 2014. Basically, it was advertised as coming with a tenant, but the special condition said that it would be vacant on completion. I didn't make anything much out of it. We thought, okay, great, it will be vacant. We want to refurbish it, sell it on. We exchanged on this in the auction. And then the day before completion, I went to see the property. That's one of the good practices, just kind of go and see the property before passing the money over to the other side, because that it becomes difficult to sort out any issues if there were any. So the day before, I went to the property and I knocked on the door, and basically the tenants were still in the property. And there was about 12 people in a 2-bedroom flat, and there were children. The flat was disgusting. There were cockroaches. It's literally the most disgusting flat I've seen. And for us, it was like, okay, we thought there might be a tenant, but obviously the special conditions said it was going to be vacant. So we expected it to be vacant, and we didn't expect to be kind of responsible for 12 people who are in this dangerous property with cables hanging from the ceiling and stuff like that, and children in the property. So we basically asked the seller to get a vacant possession. And then they argued, oh, this was just an admin mistake and the property is being sold with the tenant. We're like, no, it's not. And then it was like a massive argument, because it was the day of the completion and we refused to complete. They threatened to take our deposit, and we threatened to take them to court. And basically, it ended up with us agreeing to pay 10K more to the seller and them getting the tenant out, because the tenant was in the property for like 7 years. They were getting housing benefit, and they were advised by the council. And the council advised most of the tenants like this to wait until the eviction day to basically move out, and then they can get emergency housing from the council. Otherwise, the council doesn't provide that to them. So we just got the seller to do it. It took them about 9 months. We completed 9 months after the auction. But for us, it was actually fairly good, because the prices kept rising, and so we were kind of locked in into a price, and we got the vacant possession, and we took away the risk that we would have taken by having the tenants on and actually trying to get them out.
Wouldn't have worked so well in a falling market though, right?
In a falling market, it would have been, yeah, fairly bad. But then we could have forced the landlord to actually complete within the auction timelines, and they would have been in a breach of contract, and then they would have been responsible for our losses. So there were ways of doing it, but I guess at the time I was really nervous because it was my first auction deal and we were trying to just not lose money. And we actually made 48K after refurb and after everything was solved. So worked really well, but there were times where I was like, oh, what are we going to do?
What are we going to do indeed? That must have been going through the next buyer's mind as she realised that what she thought she'd bought and what she'd actually bought were two completely different things. Jay Howard.
I'm never going to forget this story because this is probably one of the worst things I've seen at auction. It has a happy ending, but for 2 months, this was painful to watch. Youngish girl comes into the auction with her boyfriend. They're looking at investing in HMOs. Right? I learned this afterwards, but just setting the stall out here. There was a property in Camden up for sale on 11 Bonnie Street. I'm never going to forget the address of this property. I've walked past that property several times now. It was one of the hardest properties for me and Andrew to write up, for it to make sense. Like, we had to go through it several times and went to lunch. We didn't talk about it. We went back with fresh eyes to try and figure out how to write this. So, yes, it was structured out as an HMO. Yeah? It was a five-bedroom HMO. It was producing 56-something thousand pounds per annum. But you weren't buying the house, per se. The house was subject to a commercial lease for 20 years. There was 15 years left running on it. And it was like, well, how are you getting it as a commercial lease? So the actual building was owned, the freehold of that road was owned by National Rail or subsidiary or a rail company of X. It was literally right behind Camden Street or Camden Road, I can't remember which one, station. Someone will Google it and it'll go Bonnie Street and you'll see the train line right behind it. And they basically grant commercial leases because what's the benefit of granting someone a commercial lease over a property? They have no residual residential rights, yeah? So they can't stay beyond that. There's none of the notices apply because it's all subject to a commercial lease. So they were very smart. Now, the property was probably worth maybe 1.1, 1.2 million pounds if it was the freehold, didn't have the commercial lease, and if it was structured as the HMO as it was. But the lease was 20,000 pounds a year. So if it was producing 55, you're only getting 35. I think we guided it somewhere silly, like 100 and something thousand pounds. Because obviously it was a commercial lease. It only had 15 years left, this, that, and the other. So this young girl comes in. I say young girl. She must have been maybe between 24 and 28, unless I miss my guess drastically. But she was certainly a little bit younger than me at the time. This was about 5 years ago. So she was definitely in her 20s. So she comes back. She puts the deposit down. She exchanges everything. She was really happy with her purchase. She went to the next desk, which was lawyers. And the lawyers were like, do you know what you bought? She said, yeah, I bought an HMO in Camden. I mean, MW1, like, this is the best thing on earth. I've got a deal of a century. I think paid late too, so like 280-something, 290-something. I'll try and find the sales result for that. It was quite a long time ago. And even then, on like £35,000 income, you know, on a yield basis, she still did well. This is why I hate yield as a calculation as to whether a deal is good or not, because it doesn't take into consideration all the other elements are impacting or prevalent on the property. So then she goes to the finance guys. Can't really finance you on this because we're not really sure what it is and what your relationship to it will be and what your responsibilities are. She came back to the desk and she was in absolute tears. And this was like one of the early lots in the catalogue. And she stayed there the whole day crying, asking what we could do to kind of, she didn't realise, she didn't read the thing properly. She saw the postcode, she saw HMO licence, she saw the income coming in, and she made her decision based off of that. That was a bad one, the worst thing I've ever seen.
What was the happy ending to it then?
The happy ending was the person who owned it was a lovely lady, Irish lady. Either she was Irish or she lived in Ireland. Again, it was a number of years ago. And she, obviously, this girl was in tears. I'm going to give her a deposit back and I'm going to cancel the contract. So the vendor still had to pay our fee because the property sold. I think that was probably only about £3,000 or £4,000, and she kept it. I think the owner was like, well, this is kind of forced my hand into making negotiations with the freeholder to try and buy the freehold. because maybe it would have cost her, you know, £750,000 or £1 million to buy the freehold. But it means once she bought it, she would get rid of that commercial lease and have a freehold property to sell. I don't know how that ended for the seller, but the buyer was forgiven. Sometimes you don't feel sorry for some people, but for that one, I did. I felt very sorry for her. That one wasn't an easy deal to understand on the face of it. You know, it looked like something, but when you opened it up, it was something completely different. That was a bad one.
She'd have been all right if she was a member of the Auction Buyers Club.
Yeah, we would point that out way before it got to that point. But, you know, you kind of temper feeling sorry with someone by going, why didn't you send this to your solicitor before you turned up? So there's a bit of it where you just go, you know, all of this isn't someone else's fault. You haven't acted properly. And there's a big thing, like some people go, oh, I didn't know that. It's like, well, basic due diligence would have revealed that to you. So, you know, you have to sometimes take responsibility for your own actions or your own lack of actions. So.
And it's not just buyers who end up in tears. Sally Smith is auctioneer for Lovitz.
One auction, I had a very, very emotional seller. She was actually sat on the front row and she actually started crying when it came to her lot. I knew she was sitting there and I could hear her sobbing and she was very upset. And I had to make a judgment, a very difficult judgment, as to whether she was disrupting the auction. And I took the judgment that because she was sitting at the front of the room, that the noise that she was making was projecting towards me and not actually to the other people in the room. So while I'm taking the bids and I'm dealing with it, the other part of my brain is thinking, right, if she gets any louder and I feel that she is disrupting the room, how am I going to deal with it? You know, and that's actually, from an auctioneer's perspective, that's quite difficult, because when you're taking bids and you're thinking about where you're going to go next with your increment, sometimes the other part of your brain is starting to think, right, how am I going to deal with this if this goes that way or if it goes that way?
Do you know why she was crying?
It was the emotion of the sale. She'd been emotionally attached to this property. It was a family property and she'd hung on to it for a very, very long time. It had stood empty for a very long time. Property had been cleared, so there was no personal effects left in the property, but the property had been in the family for a very, very long time, and she knew that it had to be sold. She contacted us on the basis that it needed work doing to it. It had been stood empty for a long period of time. Nobody in the family wanted it. They couldn't afford it. They didn't want to keep it, and it needed to be sold, because as it was standing there vacant, effectively it was just deteriorating in terms of its value, and she knew that it had to be sold. She was the only beneficiary from the estate. So, you know, it wasn't like she had the responsibility of the money going to anybody else. So the money was coming to her, but for her, it wasn't about the money. It was about the fact that she knew that the property had to be sold. In her mind, she wanted it to be sold to somebody who was going to put money into it, reinvest in it, live in it themselves, grow a family there. You know, she had an idyllic view as to who the purchaser was going to be. And I think it was just the reality of the fact that this was the final part of her grieving process, I suppose. I see it quite a lot where sellers are going through a grieving process with a property, because a property can mean a lot to people in so many different ways. She knew that this was just the finality of the whole process and her family home sort of moving on to another generation of occupants, I suppose.
Mary is a soon-to-be expat investor who found something unexpected when she went to mortgage a property she had bought at auction.
This one I was really happy about when I bought it, but it's easily my worst performing asset. And the reason for that is, you know, it wouldn't have been able to be picked up in the legal pack either. It has some cladding on the outside. So it's in a low block of flats. And due to the cladding, it meant that, you know, getting a mortgage was very difficult. It's 15 minutes from where I live in London. You know, my strategy actually is generally to buy within a 30-minute radius of myself. I don't want to be spending too much time traveling, you know, doing maintenance, that kind of thing. So it's 15 minutes from where I live. It's a 4-bed top floor ex-council with a little bit of cladding on the side, which I, to be honest, had no idea about. And again, I don't think would have been picked up in the legal pack either. So it was being divested by a property investor who is an expat. I think he's Australian, and he needed to divest for tax reasons. So he was selling his entire portfolio of 7 or 8 properties within a space of 3 months or so, which meant that he actually had, I think, 6 properties in the catalogue, but three of them were sold via private treating by an estate agent prior to the actual auction day itself. So only three of them went to auction. I actually went to view all of these because they're all around about the same area. And so, you know, this one, again, actually, we talk about the guide price and the reserve price. Guide price was 375. I got it for 375. The other two, one, I think, had a guide price of 325, and that sold for 375, 380. The other one had a guide price of 375 and I think ended up selling at 425. So I was the only one, I think, to place a bid on this property. And so I was over the moon being like, you know, because it was the first of the three on the day itself to come to auction. I was actually ready to buy a second one if there wasn't much competition, but I thought nobody was bidding on my one because they just wanted to test the room, see what demand was like. But I don't know whether the other investors clocked on to the fact that there was a bit of planning. So it meant that, you know, I had to cash fund the purchase. And so on an ROCE perspective, I mean, to be fair, the gross yield I'm getting on there is amazing for central London. I'm getting about 7.5% gross yield, 8% gross yield. But, you know, my return on capital is not great because it's all cash funded.
Why are you so confident that it wouldn't have been picked up in the legal pack?
Because I don't think the legal pack would say, and I did look through it, the legal pack wouldn't say, like, in the 1970s, we decided to add on additional cladding to one facade of the building to improve the insulation.
But you viewed the property, right?
I viewed the property, yeah. But I didn't know what to look out for.
Yeah, I don't think I would either, to be honest. I'm not sure I would know what's cladding and what's not.
Yeah, exactly. I had no idea. And when I tried to get a mortgage on it afterwards, a valuer came and he was looking around the building, like, knocked on the wall and said, some cladding is acceptable, but when you hear a hollow sound like this, then you know it probably is filled with flammable insulation. I was like, how am I supposed to know that? The other really frustrating thing is the government guidance is when a block of flats is less than six stories, it doesn't need an EWS one. But the RICS guidance is that if there is 25% cladding or more, then you do need an EWS one. And so because this is an ex-council flat, the council follows the government guidelines. So they don't want to do EWS ones or, you know, get a fire person round because that costs a lot of money. Whereas the mortgage lenders want an EWS one because they want to follow the RICS guidance. So I'm now stuck in a place where my mortgage broker can find a solution. But because I've cash funded the purchase, I've got to wait another 6 months or so until I can remortgage.
And that's your plan?
Yes. So I can either remortgage or actually I was calculating my LTV before coming and speaking to you. And I'm thinking that it might not be a bad thing to have one property that has no debt on it, because then my overall portfolio has an LTV of about 60%. And that, especially if we're going to come into an interest rate rising environment coming into a recession, I think it pays to be a bit more prudent.
Can you fill in the gap in my knowledge? What is an EWS1?
So an EWS1 is an external wall system form. After Grenfell, any tall blocks of flats have to have an EWS1 signed off by a fire person. I really don't know their title. Like a fire inspector. And they come around, check if the building is constructed properly. Are there going to be any other instances where, you know, let's say a lower level flat sets on fire and the rest of the building, you know, catches fire and it causes a huge amount of damage? And
is it fair to say that if you hadn't bought that property at auction, you wouldn't have ended up buying it, right?
For sure. For sure. For sure. But saying that, I think I managed to get more than a 20% discount on the property by buying at auction. So I think that's a pros and cons, really.
Would you say then that's put you off auctions?
No. No, definitely not.
Why not?
Definitely not. I think with auctions, number one, I do think the purchase price is very important. Number two, I like how quickly you can get to completion. My fourth property, which was estate agent, normal mortgage, it took nearly 4 months from offer to completion, and that really frustrated me. So I think auctions is also a way to find a property which is going to sound awful, but I like the thrill of it. Of course, I should have my rational investor hat on, and I do when it comes to the purchase price. Maybe not so much with my due diligence, though. So, yeah, it's just, I like the fact that you can kind of, you know, see properties which may not be sold normally by a prime estate agent. And I just think it's quite fun.
The dopamine rush.
It is. It is. I also think now that auctions have become so easy to do online. When I bought my second property by auction, I was at the hairdresser's for 5 hours, you know, trying to lighten my dark Asian hair. And so I was literally, you know, getting foils put in my hair. I was watching the auction on my phone and just, it was so easy. I just like press bid, 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 and that's it.
Would you say it's too easy?
No. And the reason is because the AML or the checks they do beforehand is a bit of a pain in the ass. So like when you register for the property, you have to send them loads of documents. It takes them a few days to go through it. And then you have to tell them specifically which lots you're interested in bidding on. So then once you tell them the lots you're bidding on, the system will enable you to bid only when those lots come up. And for certain auction houses, because you need to place a deposit before you start bidding, it's like, actually, that's quite a lot of cash that gets tied up if you're interested in, you know, 5 or 10 lots within the catalogue.
What advice would you give to people thinking about going into the auction market?
I think number one is definitely do your numbers and stick to it. Number two is really understand the type of property you're buying, in the sense that, you know, for my second property, which has this cladding issue, I think that's very specific, you know, to that type of property itself. So research well and get to know everything about the type of property that you're buying. I always tell people now, make sure that it's mortgageable before you place a bid.
Sally Smith points out that buying at auction is often an emotional experience.
It's interesting. There's a lot of emotion, and selling at auction is, in some respects, is very emotionless, but equally in other respects is very emotional.
As Rod Turner, host of the Rodcast podcast, can confirm.
I've seen a family have a punch-up before in the room.
Tell us about that.
It was a while ago. Funnily enough, I have seen the person involved a few times since then. I mean, this is going back years and years and years. But the guy was bidding and his family obviously disagreed with his bids. And they just had this full-on kind of Jeremy Kyle style row in the middle of the room. And yeah, and they had to be asked to leave. It was great entertainment, yeah.
So you didn't win the bid?
No, but not in the end.
No. I suppose the moral of today's episode is to expect the unexpected.
It's the old thing of kind of, I don't know, drugs and walking into a property and there being someone in there kind of doing something they shouldn't be and all that sort of stuff has happened a few times. But I mean, yeah, that's kind of what you expect from these properties. If you're buying something that's a wreck, you expect, I don't know, there's squatters in there and things like that, or people like needles and all that sort of stuff. So yeah, wear some big boots when you're looking around these properties.
This episode's highlights for me are firstly the importance of viewing a property before buying it, if only to make sure, in David Sandyman's case, that it has a front door, or that any tenants have in fact moved out if it's being sold with vacant possession. The second thing worth highlighting is Mary's advice to really understand the type of property you're buying. So if it's a leasehold property, make sure you look at the lease, and if it's tenanted, make sure you look at all the details of the tenancy, etc., etc. And finally, most importantly, when you buy a property at auction, make sure to look for any E-type Jags stashed away around the property, for obvious reasons. Continuing the World Cup theme, this week's exotic listener location is Essaouira in Morocco, which I have chosen not just because of Morocco's stunning 2-0 victory over much-fancied Belgium a few days ago, but also because I've been there, and I'd recommend you to pay a visit too. It's a pretty striking town about 2 hours from Marrakesh and provided the inspiration not only for Orson Welles' Othello, but Jimi Hendrix's Castles Made of Sand. But what I remember about it is that all the houses were painted white and blue. Happy memories. So if you're our listener in Essaouira, I'd love to know all about your expat property story and if there's anything you'd like to have more of in the show, which goes for everyone else too. So don't be shy. Get in touch via the podcast website at www.expatpropertystory.com. I've had a pretty busy couple of weeks with one thing and another, but I promise that I will get around to sending out my 23-step guide to analysing an auction deal for those who have signed up to our email subscription service, which I'll repeat just in case you didn't have a pen to hand a couple of seconds ago. But if you really can't wait for it, then you can leave me a message expressly requesting it at www.expatpropertystory.com. So that just about wraps up the auction season, and if you've had half as much value out of listening to it as I've had making it, then that's good enough for me. Please help me out by leaving a review like our mystery Hong Kong property investor. It really helps prevent pod fade, which is the phenomenon whereby lonely podcasters run out of energy and stop producing their podcast. So remember, a review a day keeps the pod fade away. And of course, share the show to spread the word. You've been listening to
Expat Property Story.